Chapter 39, Cracks in My Soul. The Democratic Senator's Serenity Prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot legislate, the courage to legislate the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference, and the patience to explain that difference to my donors. Probably the most enjoyable part of public service is the fundraising. That's because you get to spend endless hours on the phone talking with people from all walks of life, though mainly rich people, and also you mostly talk to their voicemail or assistants. Not only that, but when you do manage to get them on the phone, the people on the other end are super excited to talk to you because they know exactly why you're calling, to ask them for their support. And if you're not sitting in a small room with your call time manager, calling people for 3 or 4 hours at a stretch, you may very well be flying across the country to speak to your supporters at the sumptuous home of a wealthy donor who wisely chose not to go into public service. Or even better, you might be flying across the country in the middle of the night. Flying in the middle of the night gives you plenty of time to examine the choices you've made in your life, or to sleep, but also to write thank you notes to donors. Okay, let's back up. Unfortunately, unless you're very rich or not interested in winning, you need to raise money if you're going to run for office. You need the resources to put a team together, to rent office space, to buy phones and computers and printers and toner, to feed volunteers, to travel around your state, to make ads, and to put the ads on the air. So before I go any further, let me just thank everyone who has ever contributed to my campaigns. The vast majority of you are not wealthy and give 5, 10, or 25 of your hard-earned dollars. In fact, more than 90% of the donations I've received are $50 or less. Without the generosity of people who don't own sumptuous homes, I would not be in the position I am to fight for the things we believe in. Despite my success with direct mail and online fundraising from small donors, I have to raise a lot of money the old-fashioned way, by picking up the phone and calling rich people. And it takes a little trial and error to discover what works and what gets you a restraining order. My first fundraising call in late 2005 was to a successful St. Paul lawyer, John Farisee. Though we had never met, John took my call because he was familiar with my work as a comedian, author, and radio host. I made my pitch for the pack I had started, and John immediately agreed to give. How much was I looking for? I peered down at the notes on my call sheet. Well, I guess $5,000. John said, okay. I paused and then asked, are you sure? I remember this only because John told the story to gales of laughter at one of my fundraising dinners in 2014. Call time is just you and your call time manager, a young staffer who's printing out and handing you call sheets and reminding you about any special information you might need to remember. Maybe the person you're calling missed your last event because they were at their mother's funeral or at a child's hockey game. Or maybe they particularly love your work on fighting climate change. Sometimes you dial the phone, other times your call time manager does. Sometimes you have to do all the talking, sometimes the person you're calling talks. Sometimes they talk too much. As you dial, you peruse the person's giving history, every donation they've ever made over the past several election cycles, not just to you, but to everyone. That's all public information, by the way. Also on my call sheets are notes from A.J. Goodman, the former death row attorney who has been my national fundraising director for the last 11 years. A.J. makes the best call sheets, which include reminders like, don't call the home, the wife hates politics, or call her cell, he's a Republican, or they're divorced, no more Sharon, no more Sharon money. Am I giving you a good sense of what call time is like? Did you tune out when I mentioned giving history and then perk up a little bit when you heard death row? I don't know how interesting this sounds, but call time is less interesting than that. It's not uncommon to have 3 straight hours of call time scheduled as part of your day. During my recount, I often did 8 hours of call time in a day. It's brutal. But I probably hate call time less than most elected officials do. See, when I was in comedy, I used to edit, which involves sitting in an edit room for hours on end while a skilled craftsman makes the edits that you and your co-writer or the director request. It means reviewing all the takes for pieces of the best performances and looking for different camera angles and sizes, close-up, two-shot, wide, to cut around weaker performance moments. This can be more or less interesting than it sounds, depending on what you're editing and whether you're the one calling the shots. But whatever the case, I would always make a conscious decision to enjoy myself. You're going to be in this room for 5 hours, I would tell myself. You might as well enjoy it. That's my call time philosophy, too. Just as I try to make fundraising emails fun for the people who read them, I try to make call time fun for myself and my call time manager and for whomever I'm calling. Let's say I get the assistant of an attorney in Dallas. I'll say, "Hi, this is Al Franken calling for Mr. Hudnut." "I'm sorry, but Mr. Hudnut is in a meeting." "All right, well, I'm calling to invite him and Sandra to a fundraiser for me in Dallas on October 11th. "Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Hudnut will be out of the country on October 11th. "Uh-huh," I say. "And will the Hudnut's checkbook be out of the country?" That almost always gets a laugh, and often money. Over the course of the many hours I have spent in call time during the last decade, I have composed, as a sanity maintenance device, a musical entitled Call Time the Musical. The musical takes place in a call room with me and my call time manager, a table, and a phone. The audience can hear the phone on the other end. While it's ringing, I sing to the tune of Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. "Please answer the phone, Howard Goldfein. You maxed to me last cycle. Oh, won't you be home, Howard Goldfein?" Now, I would have sung that here, but we have a legal issue. Anyway, if there's no answer, the audience hears the Goldfein's outgoing message, an adorable little girl saying, "The Goldfeins aren't home now." And then I leave a charming message. "Elise, this is Al Franken. You have a very young-sounding voice. I guess Howard robbed the cradle. Listen, I'm going to be in Cleveland Thursday, April 7th, for a fundraiser at the home of Danny and Marilyn Lasky in Shaker Heights. And I'd love for you both to come. You can call A.J. Goodman at 555-287-6543 for all the details. A.J.'s a she, a female person. She's a woman." Then I hang up and sing Call Time's signature tune, "I Left a Message." It's the signature tune for two reasons. First, because it's so catchy and upbeat. And second, because I sing it roughly 75 times over the course of the show, which lasts 6 hours with no intermission unless I have to go to the bathroom. Also, it provides almost all of Call Time's production values, because while I sing I Left a Message, the chorus members, who include 6 ballerinas, 4 jugglers, some acrobats, and several chimpanzees riding tricycles, enter, do their stuff, and sing their parts. Starts with me. "I left a message on the phone. Woo! I left a message. They were not home. No, no, no." That was the chorus going, "No, no, no. I left a message. Oh, yes, I did. Ow, ah. I left a message. I do not kid. He left a message. Oh, yes, he did. Wah, wah. He left a message. He does not kid. Yay!" Then the orchestra plays them off to thunderous applause. Seriously, without Call Time the Musical, my call time manager and I would go crazy. You might be wondering who this call time manager is and how he or she can stand to do this job. After all, he or she has to sit through all these calls too, but never gets to talk to anyone but me. On the other hand, I am raising the funds that will be used to pay his or her salary, so there's that. But because there is a burnout rate, I've actually had several call time managers over the years, each has contributed in their own way to Call Time the Musical. The Beltway sensation Brian Heenan made a key breakthrough when he started to lavish praise upon my performance with every call. "That was a great message," Brian would say with absolute sincerity after I left a voicemail. "If I were her, I'd go to the fundraiser." Or when I'd hang up after a long call with a prospective donor, Brian would say, "On this end, from what I heard, that was a great conversation. I bet she maxes out." Now, Andy Osborne, who replaced Brian when the original cast departed, developed a running bit based on my suggestion that Rain Man would be the ideal call time manager. "Definitely call the house. 555-681-2372. Last time you called, January 27, 2009, you called the office. Definitely called the office. 555-724-0966. The assistant, Brenda Downey, said definitely call the house. Or, definitely max out to you in 2008. Gary gave $2,400 on April 12, 2007 for the primary. Attended Larry David event. Definitely attended. Another $2,400 for general. Definitely June 21st, 2008, summer solstice. Mary Alla also gave the full $4,800, also at the Larry David event. She's a big Larry David fan. Definitely loves Curb Your Enthusiasm. Definitely. Would definitely sleep with Larry David." She said that? Yes, but I added definitely. She just said, "I'd sleep with Larry David." Rain Man, she was joking. No reaction from Rain Man. Now, you'll notice I referred to Larry David. This is more than just a casual name drop like my earlier mentions of call time manager Brian Heenan and Dallas super lawyer Mr. Hudnut. One of the things Norm Coleman attacked me for during that first campaign was that I received a lot of campaign money from the left coast Hollywood elite who are poisoning our culture and contributing to the breakdown of the American family. And indeed, over the years, I've gotten a lot of support from people in show business, especially people I worked with over my 35 years in the industry. So as Republican lines of attack went, this was among the least dishonest, but that didn't make it any less silly. For one thing, like many Republicans, Coleman was raising much of his money from big oil and big pharma and big insurance. So I was happy to admit that I was raising money from what I called big comedy. It's hard to argue that Ben Stiller has been a worse influence on our country than ExxonMobil, even if you were very disappointed with Zoolander 2. But the real difference was that I had actually worked in big comedy. These were people I had made movies and TV shows with. These were people who know me personally. These were my friends. Norm Coleman, on the other hand, had never been a wildcatter in the oil fields. He had never developed a life-saving drug in the research lab of a pharmaceutical company. He hadn't spent his career before politics as an actuary in the insurance business. I got money from big comedy because my friends wanted to support me. My opponent got money from big oil and big pharma and big insurance because they wanted something from him. This is why I and many other people have long called for public financing of elections. It's not just that all this fundraising is a huge pain and a distraction from the work our elected officials should be spending their time doing, reading briefing books, or just books, talking to experts, crafting legislation, and meeting with constituents. The role of big money in our politics gives special interests a bigger megaphone than people who can't write big checks. Of course, the influence of special interests is now greater than ever, thanks to the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision in Citizens United, and the Republicans' refusal to let us do anything to bring some transparency and accountability back to our elections. In the court's majority opinion, Justice Kennedy tried to reassure people that allowing corporations, unions, and wealthy individuals to spend unlimited money in elections is really nothing to worry about. "With the advent of the Internet," Kennedy wrote, "prompt disclosure of expenditures can provide shareholders and citizens with the information needed to hold corporations and elected officials accountable for their positions and supporters." Well, in theory. Except that under Citizens United, there was no requirement that these expenditures actually be disclosed, which made it kind of hard for anyone to be held accountable. Now, we Democrats tried to pass a law that would actually mandate prompt disclosure of expenditures by the new groups that sprung up like weeds after Citizens United so that shareholders and citizens could use that information to hold corporations and elected officials accountable for their positions and supporters. We called it the Democracy is Strengthened by Casting Light on Spending in Elections Act, which by happy coincidence we later discovered could be shortened to the Disclose Act. Like any bill, the Disclose Act would need 60 votes to pass the Senate, and at the time, we had only 59, which shouldn't have been a problem. Given their past statements about the importance of disclosure, you'd have thought that Republicans would have been lining up to co-sponsor the Disclose Act. In a floor speech, I quoted my colleagues who had voted against the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform law that passed in 2002 on the grounds that we didn't need limits on campaign donations if we only had disclosure. For example, there was Chuck Grassley. "We can try to regulate ethical behavior by politicians, but the surest way to cleanse the system is to let the sunshine in." There was Lamar Alexander, who I can't imitate. "I support campaign finance reform, but to me that means individual contributions, free speech, and full disclosure." There was Orrin Hatch. "The issue is expenditures, 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 and the issue, the real issue, if we really want to do something about campaign finance reform, is disclosure, disclosure, disclosure." Even Mitch McConnell had said, "Public disclosure of campaign contributions and spending should be expedited so voters can judge for themselves what is appropriate." But as much as my Republican colleagues had sung the praises of disclosure and hailed Justice Kennedy's decision in Citizens United as wise jurisprudence, Senate Republicans secretly knew they had been handed a huge advantage thanks to the most outrageous act of judicial activism in a generation, and they weren't about to look this gift horse in the mouth. The day of the disclose vote, it was clear that the Republican filibuster would hold. I was a bit peeved at the hypocrisy, and after casting my own futile vote to move the bill forward, I stood in the well during the rest of the vote to give my good friends a bit of friendly crap. This led to the single dumbest thing a colleague has ever said to me, which is quite a high bar. After watching one of the Republicans who had spoken about the importance of disclosure 8 years earlier vote no on the Disclose Act, I asked him rather churlishly, "What happened to sunshine is the best disinfectant?" "I'm protecting the Constitution," he replied, equally churlishly, then moved on. Another Republican, however, felt the need to defend him, also churlishly. "Well, there are parts of the bill we're not comfortable with," he said. "Okay," I replied, "name one thing in the bill you have a problem with." My colleague blanked and, without responding, turned to the clerk, voting no. Another Republican colleague, having overheard the last two exchanges, said to me, civilly, I admit, though I thought I could still detect a hint of churlishness, "Well, the bill treats different entities differently." This was a line of argument Republicans used often, usually claiming that Democrats wanted to place new obstacles on the political power of corporations while further empowering labor unions. "No, it doesn't," I said, having plenty of practice knocking down this bogus claim. "It treats unions the same as corporations and the same as individuals." Now, here comes the single dumbest thing a colleague has ever said to me. "Well, let's say the New York Times prints an editorial. It doesn't have to disclose." My jaw dropped. I gave my colleague a second to figure out why that had been a spectacularly stupid argument, but it didn't seem like he was getting it. "It's in the New York Times," I explained, as unchurlishly as I could manage. "Oh," he realized, "right." Then he turned to the clerk and voted no. The proliferation of money in politics is a huge problem. And as I'll explain in the next chapter, it has some pretty terrible consequences. But does this mean that elected officials are all bought and paid for? The truth I've discovered is a little more complicated. Campaign contributions don't buy votes. What they buy is access. That's why lobbyists write campaign checks. They're not bribes, they're grease. They enable those lobbyists to come to fundraisers where they get to talk to you while you're trying to remember their names. Gross, right? And it is. I hear from a lot of lobbyists, and yes, some of them are every bit as transactional as you're imagining. But others, often the more effective ones, are actually passionate about the issue they're representing. And while lobbying, and all the money associated with it, offers lots of opportunities for corruption, lobbying itself isn't inherently corrupt. Many lobbyists represent good causes, like solar energy, or Alzheimer's research, or a woman's reproductive rights. They may have donated to you not in order to buy your support going forward, but because you've been supporting their good cause all along. And more often than not, you're not meeting with them because of a check they wrote, but rather because you're on the same team. You're strategizing together about how to move the ball forward and trading useful information about how to achieve a shared goal. That doesn't mean I'm pro-lobbyist. In fact, during my first campaign, I called for a lifetime lobbying ban on former members of Congress. It didn't seem right to me that after holding the high honor of public service, you could just cash out and make millions off your access to former colleagues. And it still doesn't. I still want to ban former members of Congress from becoming lobbyists. And for that matter, I still want public financing for elections so current and prospective members of Congress don't have to spend so much time fundraising. But the issue looks different from the inside than it did from the outside. In 2005, Norm Coleman voted for an energy bill that gave subsidies to the oil and gas industry. It was easy to draw a direct line between those votes and the money he got from big oil, and during the campaign, I drew that line with great enthusiasm. Norm's response was always that the same bill created the Renewable Fuel Standard, or RFS, which includes the ethanol mandate. Now, the oil and gas industry doesn't have a big presence in Minnesota, but we grow a lot of corn and soybeans, and corn ethanol and other biofuels like biodiesel produced from soybean oil have been extremely important to the economy of rural Minnesota. In other words, the RFS is good for my state. The oil and gas subsidies in the bill were bad for everyone except the oil and gas industry and oil and gas states. But while I'm sure Norm was less bothered by those subsidies than I would have been, the truth is that, on balance, I might well have wound up casting the same vote he did. Was it unfair for me to say that Norm was in the pocket of big oil? Nah. But was it entirely accurate to say that he only voted for this bill because he had been bought off? Probably not. In 2010, I took a trip to Israel and met with some members of the Knesset. I'd never given it any thought before, but every member of the Knesset represents all of Israel. There is no member representing the northern suburbs of Tel Aviv. Our system is different. House members in Congress represent their districts. Senators represent our states. I was elected to represent the people of Minnesota. When I'm trying to decide how to vote on a bill, whether or not something is good for my state is always at the top of my mind. But of course, it's not even close to the only consideration. Does the stuff in this bill I like outweigh the stuff I don't like? If I vote for it, can I get the senator who sponsored it to vote for something of mine? If I vote against it, can we get a better deal later? What does my staff think? What do the experts I trust say? Has Atul Gawande weighed in at all? Every so often, we have to pass what's known as a continuing resolution, which extends current levels of funding so we can keep the government open and functioning until we can agree on an actual budget. Often this is a big end-of-the-year package and may contain any number of things that are just awful, and also any number of things that are great, including one or two pieces of legislation that I myself have authored and have been fighting to pass for several years. Also, if the thing doesn't pass, the government shuts down. Obviously, there's a point at which a continuing resolution could be so bad that I'd have to vote against it, even if it meant voting against stuff I liked or even authored, or even shutting the government down. But where is that point? I mean, it would have to be a really bad continuing resolution in order for me to vote against it, unless I knew it was going to pass even without my vote, in which case maybe I could vote against it as a protest of the stuff I didn't like. Then again, on principle, shouldn't you always vote as if you were the deciding vote? I used to think that, but I gave up a while ago, and I can't even remember what the hell that was about. The point is, there are all sorts of reasons why someone might vote for something imperfect, or worse, that have absolutely nothing to do with campaign contributions. Former Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank once said, "I only voted once for someone who believes 100% of what I believe, and that's when I voted for myself the first time." The fact is that being in the institution changes the way you look at how Washington works. And you have to work hard to make sure that it doesn't change who you are. Something a constituent warned me about after I'd been in the Senate for a year or so. The woman, who was about my age, with salt and pepper hair, approached me after I spoke at a reception honoring the year's best in Twin Cities Theater. As she stared at me for a while, I could see concern growing in her eyes. "I can see out of physical reality," she informed me. "Uh-huh. You've seen corruption, and it's affected you. It's put cracks in your soul." Now, that's not the kind of thing you like to hear about your soul. But she assured me that I was a loving person with a great soul. It's just that it had been badly wounded since I'd been in Washington. She wanted me to heal my soul so it could become green and clean and good. I told her that I was going to get a massage the next day, and she thought that was a good start. The massage helped, but normally what helps my soul is getting something done for people, improving people's lives, as Paul Wellstone would say. There are plenty of potentially soul-destroying aspects of running for office and serving in the Senate. Fundraising can certainly be one of them. But you keep your eye on the prize. And it's all worth every phone call, every plane ride, every thank you note, if you can get health insurance for 20 million people. If you meet a mom whose child is alive because you help to make sure that people with pre-existing conditions can get insured. If you can get mental health care treated the same as medical care. If you can prevent an undocumented mother from being deported and separated from her American citizen children. If you can preserve net neutrality. If you can keep a family in their home. It's a privilege to be a United States Senator. Not only because you get to make this stuff happen, but because you get to work with people who are working every day themselves to make this stuff happen, Americans of goodwill. Democrats and Republicans, affluent and struggling, of every color and every faith, and non-believers, who are working to improve our country and our world. Now give me some money.